Hey, welcome. I'm Chris Lopez, host of the Valley Pod, where we talk to all the interesting people of the San Luis Valley. Joining us today in our studio on the south side of Alamosa is Sean Noonan, outdoor recreation planner for Bureau of Land Management, San Luis Valley Field Office. Sean, it's good to see you again.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
What's new with you and the BLM? That's a loaded question.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to start. There's all kinds of things going on. You know, in the most immediate sense, the weather's changing and people are getting outdoors more and more. So it's keeping us on our toes and, you know, things are coming to life again.
How long have you been with BLM and how long has BLM had the title of outdoor recreation planner?
Well, I think that title's been around for a long time. I've been with, I came to the Valley 20 years ago, got my start with the Forest Service, and then transitioned after a couple years with the Rio Grande National Forest to BLM. And so for the last 18 years, I've been with BLM here in the San Luis Valley.
You know, I have to say that a couple of times I've seen you present in Conejos, I've seen you present elsewhere. I've seen you at Adams State in the art department as you work with students on the Lobatos Bridge project, which is a BLM project we'll talk about. But every time I hear you present about BLM projects, about the lands, the federal lands that are managed in the San Luis Valley, I have a takeaway of an appreciation of the history as you tell it and give context to federal lands here, managing of federal lands, the opportunities for recreation, the opportunities for others on those federal lands. And I think you just really tell a really good story about BLM in the Valley.
I appreciate that. You know, I'm a huge believer in public lands. In general, that's something that all of us as Americans are shared owners of. You know, all 330 million people in this country now, you know, that's all the present generations and all generations yet to come. And so we're shared owners in this, you know, great, you know, we're great stakeholders in this incredible thing called public lands. For recreation specifically, I mean, I tend to think of this thing almost, you know, primeval in primeval ways or primordial ways. Recreation, literally the word recreation. And if you think about, you know, what the implications are for mind, body, spirit, you know, it's paramount to all of us to be connected to nature. And there's almost no better way to do that than on, you know, the public lands that we're blessed to have here in the Valley, which is all combined a little over 3 million acres, you know, which is an incredible thing to, you know, have for a backyard. On the BLM, we have about 500,000 of those acres, and that's that kind of like, you know, if the valley floor is in a lot of ways mostly private, you know, we're that foothills sort of band that goes around the valley until you get to the, you know, the higher elevations in the forest. But with you know, state lands, county open space lands, BLM lands, the refuge complex, the Rio Grande National Forest, and you know, that crown jewel that we're all, you know, eminently aware of, the Great Sand Dunes National Park and Preserve, you know, we're fortunate to live in, you know, probably one of the most unique places on planet Earth, period.
Yeah, you do really bring us onto those lands when you talk about them. And I wonder, when you're out there traveling around the valley and you're doing your work, where do you find the most inspiration, the most solace when you're out there on BLM lands? What's your favorite, or where are your favorite spots? And knowing someone might go find that spot too.
That's right.
You know, I'm going to guess you have some areas that you can really refresh around yourself personally.
You know, it's really cool because, you know, BLM is that, you know, one of its mottos is backyard to backcountry. And, And for a lot of these towns, these communities in the San Luis Valley that are ringed around the edges, when back in the day, you know, the center of the valley was much wetter. And so it made more sense to have, you know, these communities kind of edged around the valley. And a lot of them are a stagecoach drive away or a train stop away and that sort of thing, that sometimes the first, you know, lands that are associated with a community just outside of that community, its backyard, is BLM. And so very close to almost every community in the valley, you've got access to a really unique experience. And, you know, we sat with the Forest Service years ago and thought about, like, collectively, what is it about the San Luis Valley? How would we define it? And came up with this sort of brand of solitude in every season. And I think that, you know, you can just, like, I live in Monta Vista, and just outside the back door, you know, a lot of public lands right there. And you can go onto any of those acres and at any given time have a truly, you know, wilderness-like, you know, experience of solitude and feel like you have the whole place to yourself. And we may not always feel that way or have that forever, you know. Things are changing and we can't escape that any more than anyone else can. But in a lot of ways, you can go out and have a really unique primitive experience. And I think that, you know, that's available to everybody. One place, you know, that I was probably the first place I visited here, someone said, oh, why don't you go to Penitente Canyon, you know, on a weekend. And this was, you know, 20 years ago. And there's just something about that place that is just so kind of it's really hard for me actually to put into words. I just, like, it's just a special, special place. And I think those places exist all over the valley. That's just one for me. But, you know, you can just kind of start wandering into those canyons and just really feel something, you know, unique.
Yeah, you know, I took a drive recently from the town of San Luis to Antonito. So I came that corridor that takes you east going west,
right,
across the Badlands, I call them. and I really enjoy it. I'd never done that drive before, but my motivation was to get to Lobato's Bridge and then cross
right
west and go then Antonito and then back home into Alamosa. And I have to say that now probably has become one of my favorite areas. And I really, and we're going to talk about it, I really enjoy the Lobato's corridor, which I honestly didn't have a lot of historical context or knowledge around until I started to go to some of the presentations you've been doing as BLM puts an education center into that corridor. But I really have found that to be a special place, that canyon corridor that takes you up then going north into New Mexico or south into New Mexico and then the
right
Gorge Bridge and just that whole idea of civilization through there. And you've told some really interesting stories about that corridor. Tell us about the work BLM is doing currently and where it is with its education experience that you've been putting or working to put there at Lobato's Bridge.
Well, you're right. You know, that particular area, you know, the valley has been called the cradle of Colorado's history, you know, and that particular area that you're describing is, you know, maybe one of the, you know, the heart of the valley in a lot of ways, the cultural heart of the valley. And the history there is the natural and cultural history, and they're related, you know, geography, you know, defined how people were going to interact with the landscape. And the history of that particular area is just amazing. Every time I am engaged in one of these planning meetings or something like that, I learn something new that, you know, oftentimes is just mind-blowing about the thing. And so one of those projects that you're talking about, the Lobato's Bridge Recreation and Outdoor Classroom project that we've been working on around the Lobato's Bridge, is is one of those places where, you know, in planning for the Rio Grande Natural Area, which was a designation in 2006, and it required a planning effort in trying to get our heads wrapped around like how to plan for that, you know, it became obvious that there were a couple like nodes, places that we wanted to attract people to or where they were already going that had special significance for an otherwise natural area that, you know, was not intended to, you know, attract people necessarily. Not that they can't go out and discover it all on their own, but emphasizing places where people could gather. And that Lobatos Bridge area is just one that, you know, is a magnet, you know, and it's there's a reason why that bridge is at that spot, you know, and all of the history, 13,000 years of Native American history, all of the entradas by and the Hispano history, you know, the very worthy designation of the Sangre de Cristo National Heritage Area and that sort of being at its center, that particular spot lends itself to really a story in every direction. And someone pointed that out. I wish I had come up with it, but somebody smarter than me pointed out that everywhere you turn down there, there's this epic story that, you know, begs to be told. And really, that's what kind of started our collaboration and desire to implement this outdoor classroom for the benefit of all the generations and visitors that come to the valley and to really like kind of daylight some of these stories that, you know, are at risk of, you know, disappearing. And while there's familial connections and subject matter experts available to us, and not the least of which is the, you know, all the folks associated with the heritage area, but the university as well, local citizens, just so much information out there that is being crafted into 14 interpretive panels that will serve to, you know, help people understand that area and all of its significance. And I think it's going to be a real, you know, testament to, you know, how, you know, historically important this part of the world is.
You were working with some Adams State students recently to help build some signage or some wayfinding or some markings there for that project. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, we're one of our contractors within this project, which is a partnership with it's an experimental project that we've been doing with a group called the Great Outdoors Fund. We were able to subcontract our interpretive and graphic arts specialties with a local named Kelly Ortiz, who used to be the landscape architect on the Rio Grande National Forest, and you've seen her work all over the valley, whether you knew it or not. And so she's really kind of brought us a lot of connection with, you know, the local schools, the sculpture department at Adams State University, and then using also the high school art department or young people in the art department at North Canales County Schools, bringing them together to create these sculptures that will adorn the interpretive panels, which are wayside markers, you know, they kind of like sit at about waist high and are angled, and you look at those. And so they'll each have their own unique sculpture created by these young people, very talented young people. I've seen some of the sculptures in their formative stages, and it's going to be really cool. So they're still designing those for those 14 panels, but they'll each have, you know, a local young person's, you know, sort of stamp to identifying, you know, like, you know, a theme or whatever that is related to these interpretive panels.
Well, what I really enjoy about that project is the education component of that, because when you visit that area and then with the interpretive panels that Kelly Ortiz and the high school and college artists are working through, you really come away with a better sense of history of how the valley was settled, who was here thousands of years ago. And I think that education outdoor experience to me is one I'm really looking forward to. Where are you on that project getting to a point where you do see some of that?
Well, the overall project is, it's got a lot of site amenities, improved parking and access. It's got the outdoor classroom, which is basically a large circle of interpretive panels. We're seeking to upgrade, more formalize the boating access to the river, provide restrooms, put in some picnic tables and some benches. So a developed rec site, to be sure. And that whole project is about a little over $700,000. And we've been seeking grants, raising money, fundraising. That's really what the Great Outdoors Fund is trying to do, is to, find the funds for this project. And so we're getting darn close. We've got maybe one major piece left. We tried to get a Great Outdoors Colorado Community Impact Grant last fall and came up short on that. And so we're trying again. Not too surprising. You don't necessarily get these things on the first go round, but we've got one more. We have another round in the hopper. And so we're continuing to apply for grants, and we're maybe like about... depending on some of the grants that are currently out there right now, if they come in, great. We'll be maybe 300 to 400,000 short. So that community impact grant would make probably seal the deal, and we'd be in business for the entire thing. We're expecting to put in a couple of the amenities this year, maybe the parking area, maybe the vault toilet as well. So getting a start on that by the end of this calendar year. And then, we'll just see where grants fall and fundraising continues. And originally we were hoping to, have a ribbon cutting in the fall of this year. Now that'll be pushed off maybe until hopefully spring to early summer of next year.
These projects take some time, as you note. And I wonder, mm-hmm. when you think of BLM across the country and BLM over the past decades, past short period of history, has really tried to facilitate more recreation on those federal lands versus leasing for cattle grazing, leasing for oil exploration, other things that BLM traditionally has worked those lands. And it seems like BLM is really focused on a user experience of recreation now. And I wonder how that came to be, why that came to be, and what the number of visitors are that come on to BLM lands in the valley in terms of people using them, recreating them, walking, biking, whatever it is that experience is that you can get out there on those federal lands.
Well, the BLM... really kind of got its start with the scraps that were left over, the lands literally that nobody wanted. The agency was formed right after World War II, and it combined one of the oldest agencies in the nation, the Government Land Office, and the Grazing Service. And, people typically would tongue-in-cheek call it the Bureau of Livestock and Mining. And those were two of its most, a couple of its most important or typical uses of the landscape. And as time has gone by, we're a multiple-use agency. And so it's a reflection, really, the rise in outdoor recreation. It's really just a reflection of what people want out of the agency and their public lands. And so that's occurring nationwide, really with all land management agencies. And, proximity, I think, has lent itself to that as well. A lot of what we are doing is related directly to communities and being their backyard. And so, communities have proposed various things like trail systems and the like, and what they want out of those those lands, and we're responsive to that. And so that's just a reflection, really, of what the people want out of BLM. BLM now has a brand new recreation strategy. It's called the Blueprint for 21st Century Outdoor Recreation. And it exactly, it's basically an acknowledgement that, yes, outdoor recreation is becoming an increasingly important part of the agency. And so growing and expanding outdoor recreation, we're increasing our partnerships, which is really what we do, is, you know, we don't have a lot of people. We rely heavily on our partners, and we've got the, you know, I think the greatest partners anybody could ever ask for, that are doing a lot of that yeoman's work for us and on behalf of us, and trying to meet with the demand. There's been significant rise in population in Colorado over the last several years. The COVID pandemic, you know, sort of had an explosion of outdoor recreation. When there was nothing else to do, you could go outside, and people did. And so trying to keep up with all of that demand, trying to plan for durability and resiliency relative to a changing climate. You know, all of these things are things that we're trying to do, that strategy basically is like, okay, we're unfolding a new era here, and this is how we're going to address it.
What are the corridors of BLM managed lands in the valley that see recreation? I'm going to guess it's the Del Norte corridor, Rio Grande County up in there, Alamosa to some extent, but more the western part of the valley, I guess, than the southern reaches. I don't know. That's just a guess of mine.
Well, our busiest place is probably the third busiest public lands destination in the valley, which is the Pot of Falls Recreation Area. And, of course, it has, I think just in terms of BLM recreation planning, it's really a zone of the greater park experience. But when you have a waterfall that's right next to a national park, you know, that's a destination and it's easily accessible, you're going to have a lot of people visit there.
See, I didn't realize Zapata was BLM managed.
Right.
I didn't make that connection. I've been up there.
Yeah. Well, you know, there are some goofy kind of things where certain things seem like, this should be the forest. And then the forest has certain things that seem like that's got to be the BLM. And, you know, so it's not like this magic line out there, but yeah, Zapata Falls is really kind of a combination of management. You know, it's related to Canales County and their tourism goals. The gateway to the falls is BLM, and that's where our day use area and our campground are. And then the falls themselves are on state land board lands. And then it leads off of that into the Rio Grande National Forest and the Sangre de Cristo Wilderness. But that's our busiest single destination. But, you know, in addition to community kind of rec areas, like you mentioned, in Del Norte, there's a lot of interest in trails. And so immediately outside of Del Norte, we have a Pronghorn Trail system. We have destinations like Penitente Canyon, which are, you know, defined kind of by their geography. It started as a rock climbing area, and that's where the rocks were. It's kind of morphed into a combination of rock climbing and become increasingly important for its trail system. In the north end of the valley, in the Poncha Loop, Poncha Pass area, you get all of that pressure, you know, coming from the major urban areas and the other, you know, major rec areas in the state, you know, continue to expand there, you know, it's pushing people over the hill into our neck of the woods. And so those are high intensity rec areas that, you know, we're having to, you know, quickly adapt in our management to absorb that kind of effect as well. But, you've got magnet areas like Zapata Falls or maybe the rocks at Penitente Canyon. You've got unique features like wetlands that you don't think of as being BLM, but that's we have a major wetland complex called Blanco Wetlands just outside of Alamosa here. And then, of course, the Rio Grande Natural Area and the river corridor that you described, kind of extending from Alamosa National Wildlife Refuge to the New Mexico border and all of the related lands, you know, that connected to us in New Mexico. They're all unique unto themselves, but those are some of our biggest tourist destinations for sure.
Can you get a sense of, through BLM, can you get a sense of number of visitors annually into BLM lands in the valley? And I wonder about that because unlike the sand dunes, which, you know, has a gate or has a check-in there, they can right. tell you, you know, we've seen 600,000 people or so that have come through the sand dunes on an annual basis these days. I don't know if BLM can take the same type of measurements in terms of people and how many are coming in and what type of growth that might be. You alluded to some of that
right.
going back to the COVID period and before in terms of people wanting to recreate more and more.
Well, nationwide, BLM is trying to get its head wrapped around this very, very issue because historically, we probably haven't done as good a job as we could have. But the need for that information and understanding, you know, really what's happening out on the landscape is becoming, you know, more important by the day. That, you know, we rely on a little bit of associated information, whether it's, you know, information collected by the counties, the state of Colorado, Great Sand Dunes National Park, the National Visitor Use Monitoring every 5 years from the Forest Service that has connections, because a lot of times in order to get to the forest, you got to go through the BLM. And so we get information that way. We do have some vehicle counters that we're hoping to expand that. Valley-wide, last year we reported about 640,000 visitors. And it's hard to know if that's a really good number. And I'll give you an example. At Penitente Canyon, I reported that we had about 40,000 visitors. And some of that is, you know, extrapolating, like, you know, what we monitor, you know, during a week, during weekends, you know, the differences there, how many people are in vehicles when they get there. You know, what is the different type of use throughout the year occurring? How many people were related to permitted activities like outfitters and guides? Some of those kind of things. And you know, we reported 40,000 visitors for that recreation area. Well, San Luis Valley Great Outdoors Coalition, which is establishing a small, like, kind of tiny home village adjacent to Penitente Canyon, use some more modern ways of getting to that answer, like geofencing type methods using cell phone data
right.
and that sort of thing.
Right.
And they estimated that it was closer to 60,000.
Interesting.
And so that's a big disparity. And right now, the U.S. Geologic Survey is working with BLM nationally to try to help us get better information and better methods of learning exactly how many visitors are out there and where they're going, and using kind of all of the above strategies. But yeah, it's hard to know if we're either wildly low, you know,
right.
or not.
Well, I'm going to guess too that one of the reasons BLM, you, the staff here, has to figure that out is as you work your strategy of recreation, managing public lands, et cetera, you have to make a case for funding at the federal level to be able to get dollars to provide maintenance, management for all these federal lands. And I'm going to guess someone said, well, how much are you telling us that you have people on there and that you're growing people using these federal lands, but you don't have a way to prove that to me? I'm going to guess that's one of the reasons, because of those federal appropriations and those federal dollars and that budget that BLM relies on.
That's right. And the urgency is kind of reflected in that new strategy that we just kind of call the blueprint. And it's basically saying, you know, we need to get a better understanding of what's happening out on the land so that we can make a better case to Congress on funding needs. And, you know, we're seeing the impacts of that increase in population. We're seeing the impacts of, a hotter and drier environment. And so it's essential that we understand, you know, like are able to, you know, more accurately define, you know, what is occurring out there on the public lands. How many people really are we trying to support? What are we trying to do? And ultimately, it's to make that kind of a fundamental change of, instead of always being reactive, trying to be proactive and to, you know, stay, you know, in at least in step, if not ahead, in some cases of the kind of use that is occurring and likely to continue to occur.
Well, and as you know too, as well as anyone, you do get community pushback against some of the projects, some of what you have designed or maybe want to do. We're going to keep talking about that when we come right back. This is the Valley Pod. We're with Sean Noonan with the Bureau of Land Management. We'll be right back.
Are you a member of the Monta Vista Co-op? Now is the best time to become a member and take advantage of the benefits. Propane, oil, crop protection, drone application, farm and ranch supplies, and much more. Visit mvcoop.com and follow us on Facebook and Instagram for all company sales, promotions, community events, and job opportunities. Serving our community since 1949, the Monta Vista Co-op is committed to providing the highest quality products and services. Call us at 719-852-5181 or visit our website, mvcoop.com, today. Monta Vista Co-op, community committed, agriculturally driven.
Hey, we're back. We're talking to Bureau of Land Management's John Noonan. He's head of recreation planning, outdoor recreation planner for BLM here in the San Luis Valley. We've been talking about all the different projects, the uses that you see on the BLM lands here in the valley. And Sean, one thing, there's community meetings that have been going on. Mm-hmm. There's another one coming up here in April, April 16th. And the meetings are around the idea of establishing a national conservation area, designation national conservation area for that corridor we've talked about from the Alamosa Wildlife Refuge, essentially, then going up into the Lobatos Bridge corridor and following that path. Those can be contentious meetings. You can see community members showing up and really pushing back or pushing against the idea of, in this case, of a national conservation area. But even more than that, you will get people who don't want or, for whatever reason, push against federal management or BLM managing lands. I don't quite get all of that. Hear some of the conversations.
Yeah.
How do you work that part of the puzzle in terms of your engagement with community? How do you accept the pros and cons, the people that oppose? I've seen you in action in some of these meetings, and you do a really good job of slowing everything down, the process, the conversations when you get them to explain. And you do a really good job of explanation, I think, in terms of given reasons for why things are happening. And I find that really helpful. But I wonder, you know, you do get opposition out there. How do you handle, manage that? And why do you think you see opposition at times to some of these projects, in this case, the national conservation idea?
Yeah. Well, my job is to be a liaison to this working group and to this community element that is exploring the idea of a potential national conservation area designation. And it didn't necessarily start off as, you know, does it need to be a national conservation area? I think it's kind of like, you know, gone down that road more as opposed to some other type of a designation, such as the one that's adjacent to this particular area. And we're talking about mainly those BLM lands that are east of 285 from the New Mexico border up to, you know, there's a large chunk of BLM, about 90,000 acres or so, that goes up to the McIntyre-Simpson property. And what that, and with a boundary kind of, you know, loosely of the Rio Grande itself, and the highway and those public lands that are in between that. So national conservation areas are a type of management designation that Congress created specifically for the BLM to manage landscapes. And so this is kind of a large chunk of land. It's a landscape. What it isn't is, you know, a sort of a takeaway. Because the lands, as I mentioned before, are already owned by the 330 million Americans that exist today and all future generations, you know, that will come henceforth. And that won't change whether this particular area of land is designated as an NCA or not. An NCA is really just a landscape level management tool. You know, it's just a sort of an umbrella for, you know, almost think of it as like kind of like a land use planning or a zoning theme for a large area. And so just explaining like, you know, what it is and what it isn't, is really kind of my role in this thing. We're not, BLM isn't itself proposing this. The idea has been around for decades. And it's been connected to the larger landscape of what is now the Rio Grande del Norte National Monument and the Taos Plateau. And this is really just a continuation of that that landscape. But you've got the geopolitical border of the state line. And so, you know, different elements have different ideas about what to do. And so on the Colorado side, it seems like the idea of a national conservation area is more amenable than, say, a national monument designation. And one of the fundamental distinctions is that NCAs are designated by Congress, whereas a national monument is typically designated by the president. So in regards to that, you know, it's still, NCAs are still multiple use areas, but it's really more of a way for a community to define through Congress how it wants to see that landscape managed for the long term.
And I think, you know, one of the keys that you said in that explanation, again, I really appreciate the explanation and context you give to some of these topics and some of these hot conversations that occur out there, because BLM already is managing those lands. It's not changing that. But you hear that people get an interpretation that they're going to lose access to lands, or their lands are getting taken away from what they've been used for, and those really aren't the cases or the situation, particularly in this specific example of a national conservation area designation for that corridor. There's nothing being taken away per se.
No, and, you know, really the way to think about land use planning is you do it every day. Like, for instance, you know, just in your house, you know, it's really just zoning. And, you know, it's like maybe your house has, you know, a grand entrance or something, the front door. But there might be a back door or a side door. You know, these are access points. You go in, maybe there's a mudroom. That's a staging area or something. You've got the living room or the good room next door, and it's got certain uses as well. The heart or the workhorse maybe of your home is the kitchen and that sort of thing. Well, this and those sorts of, you know, planning allocations, those kind of zoning decisions are already in place and being managed. You know, we'll be updating our management plan here hopefully in the near future. Our current resource management plan, which is our overarching document, our 30,000 foot, you know, above ground look at how to manage the landscape for the entire BLM lands in the San Luis Valley, goes back to 1991. So we're you know there's only a couple of field offices in the state of Colorado that are due for a revision, and we're one of them. So that'll be happening sooner than later. And we'll be redefining like that sort of, interior design, land use planning kind of framework again. A national conservation area designation is another zoning tool, but it's really kind of more like, what is the outside of this house, going to look like and act like and feel like. So that's just kind of how I typically think about it or whatever. It isn't necessarily I think there tends to be some misinformation about there's going to be a designation, so therefore we must be getting something taken away. Right. Actually, the opposite could be true. It just depends. And so really that's why this working group is trying to take a look at like what other similar and recently designated areas or other areas that are currently seeking a designation similar to what's being proposed in this neck of the woods, what they're doing, how they've dealt with it, not just in Colorado, but around the nation. And, so they're doing a great job, I think, of learning, what are ways to, better explain this and that sort of thing.
Well, from your perspective too, I would think, or let me ask you this question, is there an advantage when it comes to funding and having dollars coming in to help manage and maintain lands? Is there a benefit if Congress designates a national conservation area, in this case here in the valley that we're talking about? Does that potentially, or does that then open up federal dollars to manage, maintain that if it's designated a national conservation area versus just left alone, it's already BLM land. Now you have to manage it yourself, your staff, the staff there. You have to pay attention to those lands now, one way or the other.
For sure.
Does an NCA give you more hope then for funding to help do that?
It does. A national conservation area is going to be, if designated by Congress, put into the status of being a national conservation lands unit. And so that gives it some funding. It's far from a get-rich-quick scheme by any means, but it does allow for some specific funding for that area under the designation. And that can improve, all sorts of natural and cultural resource opportunities and offer greater protections and deconflicting, uses and those sorts of things. An example of, but it's really all that's what's written into the act. And so that's kind of an overarching theme of like, an NCA is not a cookie cutter thing. It's a general idea, but each one of them has its own unique characteristics based on what is written into those specific acts. It's a landscape conservation designation at its heart, but some of the details can be unique to the area, and I'm sure that would be the case here. An example of whether it gets rolled into the a national conservation area designation or it remains outside, is one thing that's being discussed, and that's one of the things that'll be discussed at this April 16th meeting at the Lady of Guadalupe Parish in Canales County, and that's at 6 p.m. at the parish hall.
On the 16th, yeah.
On the 16th. And so we'll have people representing the water community. David Robbins, Nathan Coombs, Craig Cotton. Well, I'll be talking about
bringing the heavyweights out.
That's right. And it's good. It's good to have that perspective. The Rio Grande Natural Area has, of course, a connection with water, and that act, which established it, had very specific language in it related to water. And so whether or not the Rio Grande Natural Area, which is adjacent to this proposal, gets rolled into it, which is what they did with the monument in New Mexico, there's a wild and scenic river there that is within the monument, or whether it remains separate and adjacent. One thing they are seeking to fix is that the Rio Grande Natural Area was never placed as a unit in the National Landscape Conservation System. And so you had to specify that and write that into the language of the act. And so it doesn't get any additional funding for management. And now, you know, in retrospect, it seems like that was an oversight and all the things that people would like us to do, both internally and externally, you know, we're not afforded any additional funding for that particular area, even though it's a congressionally designated area. It's not a unit in the National Landscape Conservation System. So, you know, those conversations are important about that, but, you know, to provide a little bit of funding that, you know, might benefit all of those multiple uses, and try to organize, you know, organize those uses. You know, themes that I'm hearing a lot of in these meetings are preserving and protecting traditional uses of the landscape, such as livestock grazing, you know, firewood collecting, you know, plant and animal harvesting, the open space, the relatively undeveloped character, you know, of the area. And some of those things are, you know, themes that have been emerging from that, and to, you know, deal with, you know, the horses that are out there, some of the trespass livestock that are out there. That funding would, you know, lend itself to dealing with some of the issues that are out there.
Yeah, and, you know, one of the things that's, for me, it's interesting as I hear you talk in this conversation this morning, and I start to wonder, because I think the job you have, BLM, I've said this to others about their jobs, U.S. Forest Service, Great Sand Dune Superintendent, if you love the outdoors, if you like lands, recreating, stewardship of lands, these are really good jobs. These are really cool jobs. And it gets me back to, for anyone listening out there that's a young person that wants to do that type of work, how do you find yourself on a path to work outdoors, to work with the BLM, work with the Forest Service, what have you, whatever it is, National Park System? Because those are, for me, those are, and you have a lot of those opportunities, and we see that experience really up close and personally here in the San Luis Valley. And someone like you comes in and you gain such knowledge of what you're doing, the work you're doing, the land you're managing. I find that really an inspiring career path for some people. How would they do that?
I agree, and I'm inspired by it all the time, and energized by, you know, stewarding the lands on behalf of the American people, you know, as best as we can under the circumstances that we're experiencing at any given time, is a real privilege and an honor to be a part of, and it's really like a, you know, it's a call to service. One of the groups that's done a great job of answering that exact question of how do I get into this line of work is the Colorado Youth Corps Association. Mm. And you can go on to their website. We use mostly the Southwest Conservation Corps, Los Valles Southwest Conservation Corps, which services, you know, southwestern Colorado, a little bit of northern New Mexico. And on their website, they have a guide for how to, you know, what types of careers exist in public lands management or outdoor related fields and how to get into them. And so I would direct people to their experience or their guide on how to get into it based on all of the experience that they've had trying to, you know, get young people that have worked for them that want to continue to pursue those careers. We're trying to expand our relationship as we speak with Adams State University and interns that we get from the university. So in relative disciplines, you know, there's you know, a top 20 kind of different categories of like what we do in the BLM. And so whether you're a geologist or whether you're a wildlife biologist or, you know, whether you're an outdoor recreation or a rangeland management specialist or a geographic information specialist, all of those elements that make up the organization, you know, administration, you don't think about it as [S2] Right. [S1] Much, but it's kind of the backbone that everything operates off. All of those, you know, things have opportunities somewhere, somehow for potential internships. You can go on to USA Jobs and apply for like seasonal positions. And then really, like, you know, one of the best ways is just to engage with, you know, a place that you might want. If your dream is to work, you know, at some place on the BLM or the forest or the refuges or the Great Sand Dunes or anything or Colorado Parks and Wildlife, you know, or the local, open space, you know, county open space or municipal outdoor rec departments, go talk to them and get on their radar screen. And that's an important first step because, you know, as much as you want to, you know, push your way in, it also helps if someone can pull too.
Yeah. Yeah, that's good advice, and good advice on the Carl Youth Corps and the work that they do there. Let me ask you one more question again. We really appreciate all the time you gave us this morning. We're working on another project on bicycling and trying to understand a little bit better how popular bicycling is, how many people bicycle, how many recreation bicyclists are out there in Alamos in the San Luis Valley. And I wonder, when it comes to bicycling or mobility on BLM paths, where are those zones in the valley that lend themselves to bike trails, mountain biking, that type of experience, outdoor experience? Where are those?
Well, nationally, bicycling, especially mountain biking, is one of the fastest growing sports in the nation. And so individuals, communities approach BLM constantly with, you know, ideas for trails and that sort of thing. Again, it kind of ties back into zoning. So we're responsive to what individuals, organized groups, communities want out of us, and so we consider it. We've got a number of, I think, world-class trail systems that are outlets for people that want to get into biking, especially, you know, in a wildland setting, mountain biking in particular. Penitente Canyon Recreation Area, you know, just west of La Garita, great system of mountain bike trails, a little over 20 miles there of single-track trails. For the most part, our trails are multiple use, so they kind of graduate. They go from foot, horse, and bicycle, and that use there is mostly bicycling, followed by probably hiking. You know, right outside of Del Norte, we've got the Pronghorn Trail system, you know, maybe another 17 miles of single-track trails that you can ride right out of Del Norte onto county or community lands and adjacent BLM lands and back again. And those are a great single-track trail system, and that's also really heavily in mountain biking as well. You know, just going a little bit further east along the 160 corridor, you get to the Limekiln area. And within Limekiln, you know, you might know this from like the rifle range or the old Spanish Trail monument that are along 160. Those are kind of like gateways to that larger chunk of BLM there. Within that, you've got the Stone Quarry Trail system kind of in the rocks. It's mostly mountain biking, and it's got about 20 miles of trails weaving in and around, real popular area for bicycling. And there's you know, within these trails, there's different areas that have, you know, like different skill levels that might be needed. And so other people are better at this than I am. I would look into SLV Go. I would talk to Christie Mountain Sports and other mountain sports stores, other bicycling vendors, and you know, that's one good way to get that information even better than I know. The Limekiln area also has a large single track trail network that is a lot more like open and flowing and expansive. And it actually goes up to motorcycles. So foot, horse, bike, electric bike, and motorcycles all on single track trails. And to the south of that, Greeny Mountain, there's an emerging number of trails that have been in development in recent years. And so it's a smaller sort of system, connects mainly with roads, but other opportunities for, you know, bicycling as well.
Some really world-class bike happening here in the valley, mountain biking, people coming in, participating, taking advantage of those trails, it sounds like.
And these were promoted, proposed by locals that, you know, we've got some great bicycling enthusiasts around here. And the systems are, you know, really, really, world class. You know, if we were anywhere closer to Denver, you would know that.
Right. Or in Moab, Utah, or exactly. Something like that. Right. They're discovering the valley, though, have a sense, and you're seeing more and more people coming in, participating and recreating on BLM lands and just federal lands here in the valley as a whole. We really, again, appreciate your time, Sean, for coming in and talking to us. Hey, you've been listening to the Valley Pod and our episode with Sean Noonan, BLM Outdoor Recreation Planner. Valley Pod is produced by Owen Woods and is part of the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. We'll see you around the valley. See you on the trails.
Hi, I'm Marty Jones, host of the Outdoor Citizen podcast. Join us every other Wednesday as we talk to outdoor enthusiasts, wildlife experts, recreationists, lovers of the outdoors, and people who spend their days and their lives outside. On the Outdoor Citizen, we talk all things outside and outdoors, provide you with the latest data and measurements for water and weather, give you upcoming outdoor events, and keep you up to date on the latest news. The Outdoor Citizen is brought to you by the AlamosaCitizen.com podcast lineup. You can listen wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, enjoy the out of doors.